in the Old Testament. I believe a good subtitle for this book is the statement, "Let us leave Egypt so we may worship the Lord." And you find this in Exodus, early part of Exodus, when Moses is talking to Pharaoh, and he tells Pharaoh, God says, "Let my people go, and we will go out into the wilderness. We will worship him." And Pharaoh refuses. But as God works on Pharaoh with the plagues, eventually God's people are released, and they ultimately do go out into the wilderness of Sinai to worship him. The author, once again, as we learned last week, is Moses. Go ahead and take a second to read Exodus 17:14. "And the Lord said unto Moses, Write this for a memorial in a book, and rehearse it in the ears of Joshua, for I will utterly put out the remembrance of Amalek from under heaven." Sorry about that. Okay. And then in Mark 12:26-27. In Mark 12:26-27, Jesus called Exodus the book of Moses when he was describing God as being the God of the living and not the dead. Let me go ahead and read that one. "And as touching the dead, they that rise, have ye not read in the book of Moses how in the bush God spake unto him, saying, I am the God of Abraham, and the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. He is not the God of the dead, but the God of the living. Ye therefore do greatly err." All right. So in this, Exodus is also one of the points, the first point at which God reveals his proper name, I am, Jehovah, I am, Yahweh, meaning that he always exists. There is no past, there is no future, there is no present for him. He always is. And that is what Jesus is emphasizing there when he talks about God being the God of the living and not the dead, because if the people who die on earth are still in existence, then they must be with God. So key people in the book of Exodus, Yahweh, God himself, although it is not strictly correct to refer to Yahweh as a human being, he is definitely a person that merits mentioning, who also forms a central part of the book of Exodus. This was first recorded mentioning of this proper name of God. So let's go ahead and turn to Exodus 6:1-6. I'd like you all to see this as we read it. Exodus 6:1-6. "Then the Lord said unto Moses, Now shalt thou see what I will do to Pharaoh, for with a strong hand shall he let them go, and with a strong hand shall he drive them out of his land. And God spake unto Moses and said unto him, I am the Lord. And I appeared unto Abraham, unto Isaac, and unto Jacob by the name of God Almighty, but by my name Jehovah was I not known to them. And I have also established my covenant with them, to give them the land of Canaan, the land of their pilgrimage, wherein they were strangers. And I have also heard the groaning of the children of Israel, whom the Egyptians keep in bondage, and I have remembered my covenant. Wherefore, say unto the children of Israel, I am the Lord." Now, do you notice how when you read Lord in that verse, all the letters are capitalized? In the Bible, when you see that, that refers to the proper name of God, Jehovah, being written in the text. And that's just how they notated that. So Jehovah, one of the primary figures in the book of Exodus. Also, there's Moses. Moses was the leader of the children of Israel. You couldn't very well have an exodus, which means coming out of someplace, if you didn't have a leader to guide the people out. He was also the one who communicated directly with God to write down the law on Mount Sinai. Aaron, Moses' brother, also became Moses' spokesman to Pharaoh because Moses claimed he was slow of speech and was not able to communicate very well. Ultimately, he became the high priest. But then you are also told about Miriam, Moses' sister. Also, Joshua, the next leader that God began to groom for leadership as early as the fight against Amalek in chapter 17. And then Pharaoh. It would be impossible to have any developing story without a conflict. In this book, Pharaoh is the character that God raised up specifically to show his power. Let's read Romans 9, verse 17. For the scripture saith unto Pharaoh, Even for this same purpose have I raised thee up, that I might show my power in thee, and that my name might be declared throughout all the earth. So this Pharaoh, who turned out to be one of the greatest enemies to the children of Israel, was in fact placed there specifically by God so that he could show his power. When was the book of Exodus written? Exodus was written around 1400 to 1450 BC. If you'll remember from last week, that was also the same time that the book of Genesis was written. Background and setting. Exodus begins in the land of Egypt, but then it follows Moses to Midian, which we believe was northwest Saudi Arabia, back into Egypt by way of the Sinai Peninsula, and ultimately concludes near Mount Sinai as the people are camping in front of the mountain receiving God's communication about the law and then the tabernacle. Timing. There is a gap of several hundred years between Exodus 1:6 and 1:8. This was foretold to Abraham in Genesis 15:13 through 16. Go ahead and read that one as well. To Abram, know of a surety that thy seed shall be a stranger in a land that is not theirs, and shall serve them, and they shall afflict them 400 years. During this time, the Israelite nation multiplied until they filled the land, and their astounding success led a Pharaoh who was not familiar with Joseph at the end of that 400 years to enslave them. But still, they continued to multiply. Finally, to curb the Israelites' incessant growth, Pharaoh ordered all the baby boys to be killed at birth. Moses' parents disobeyed the king's commands, and he became Pharaoh's daughter's son, a prince of Egypt. Key word in the book of Exodus, I believe, would be deliverance. Perhaps the key concept and the reason the book was written is to describe the Israelites' deliverance from bondage and restoration to the promise of God. God had never forsaken them, but as they waited in bondage, they began to cry out for deliverance, and he delivered them. Key doctrines. There are two key doctrines in the book of Exodus that had long-lasting implications. Some of them, actually both of them, continue to affect us today. The first is the name of God. I've already mentioned this. God first revealed his unchanging existence, that is part of his name in this book, the name I Am. Then God also gave the Ten Commandments, the codification of God's law that is rooted in his character as God. The Decalogue convicts people of sin because it is impossible for anyone to follow it perfectly. And really, just as important as the second point was, is also the fact that the law is an impossible standard for men to meet. In Romans 4:15, Paul says, "For where no law is, there is no transgression." The law also established the need for a blood sacrifice to atone for sin. As a matter of fact, the second half of the book is dedicated to describing the kind of worship that God wanted from his people, more specifically, the tabernacle where he wanted that worship to center. The first, the giving of the law. Genesis, if you'll remember, recounts several points in the progression of the revelation about salvation. The first was man's sin. But then came the promise of the coming seed shortly after that. And then God chose Abraham after the Tower of Babel to be the father of the Jews and ultimately the Messiah. God's choice of Abraham to be the father of the Jews, and then ultimately, then later in Genesis, he got that even narrower to Judah being the son of being one of the 12 tribes. Exodus then narrows that further by giving the law, which, as we just said, showed all men are sinners and cannot fix their problems by their own efforts. Another theme is the introduction of the tabernacle. This described God's physical residence while the Israelites were in the desert. So when the pillar of smoke or fire rested over the tabernacle, the Israelites stayed put, but when it moved, they moved. The tabernacle became the center of Jewish life until they arrived in the Promised Land. And that was actually quite literally the center. If you read the description, you find out that the tribes were arranged in a circle around the tabernacle. This did not include, however, the description of the tabernacle did not include the majority of specific commands about sacrifices, etc. Now, these came later, as we'll continue looking at in the next couple weeks. So what happened in the book of Exodus? Well, first, there's Israel in Egypt. So the book starts by recounting how Joseph died, and then the transition to Moses. That's in chapter 1. But then Moses, after he enters the scene, chapters 2 through 4 talk about how Moses moved around and ultimately matured into the leader that God could use to take his people out. And then Moses came back into Egypt in chapter 5, and for the next several chapters, we read a very interesting account, including the 10 plagues, and then also the preparation for the very first celebration of Passover. In this time, Moses challenged Pharaoh with God's power. The next step is Israel on the way to Sinai. As they exited Egypt, they were pursued by Pharaoh, and then they crossed the Red Sea in a very miraculous display of God's power as he split the sea, allowing them to walk across on dry land. And then as they moved from the Red Sea to Sinai, there are many interesting accounts of how God then provided them with food and the bitter waters made sweet again. Israel then encamped at Sinai, and this is where the better part of half of the book occurred. In this time, God called Moses up into the mount to talk with him, where he gave him the law, the Ten Commandments. He also then described the tabernacle, how he wanted it built, what he wanted it made out of. But then, while God was in the middle of describing this place of worship to Moses, at some point, the children of Israel decided that they needed a physical God to worship, a God who could take the place of the one that had led them out of the land of Egypt. So they pressured Aaron into making this golden calf so that they could worship him, or it, in the place of God. At this point, they corrupted the worship that God had designed and directly communicated that they should obey. But then God's presence was confirmed in the tabernacle, and they constructed the tabernacle. That is where the book of Exodus leaves off. Challenges in Exodus. Critics have a hard time with Exodus for a very understandable reason if you rule out God. Exodus records numerous supernatural events. For example, I just mentioned the plagues and the splitting of the Red Sea. But how do you account for something this strange, so completely foreign to the modern concept of reality, if you don't have a God? So one of the questions that they will frequently ask and encounter with is that the plagues could not have happened. And one argument that they will cite is that there is no Egyptian record of the plagues happening. Well, there is a solution for this problem, and that is that just like in many monarchies, even up until recent times, and some still today, writing about a king negatively is strictly forbidden and actually could result in severe consequences for those who did. So it makes sense that a king that struggled and had such terrible defeat as the Pharaoh in the book of Exodus with all these plagues, it makes sense that the people would not have written about it. As a matter of fact, he was considered a god, so writing negatively about your gods doesn't do well for your self-image, I wouldn't think. The same reasoning supports the veracity, or the truth, that the whole book of Exodus is in fact the product of God's own hand. So if people in the old times did not write negative accounts of their own leaders, then why does the book of Exodus give such a honest picture of the Israelites' failures to honor God? Such an honest accounting would have been taboo in any society in that time. But the fact is, these accounts are present, and in some cases they seem to be even more startling, especially with the golden calf. I mean, God had just led these people out of the land of Egypt, and yet they can't even wait for 40 days before they're worshiping a golden calf. How unthankful can you get? And yet that's recorded with great detail. I believe that God included these negative events because he did not want to leave people today and people in the future thinking that the children of Israel were perfect. They definitely weren't, just like we aren't. Christ in the book, Yahweh, the proper name of God. I've already discussed that, but Jesus actually used this name in reference to himself. In particular, John 18, 4 through 6. I'm going to go ahead and read that for you. Jesus, therefore, knowing all things that should come upon him, went forth and said unto them, Whom seek ye? A little bit of context here. This is referring to when Jesus is in the Garden of Gethsemane right before Judas came with the people and betrayed him. And Jesus, knowing that everything was about to happen, went out to him and addressed them, saying, Whom seek ye? Then the people who were coming to arrest him said, Jesus of Nazareth. Jesus saith unto them, I am he. Now, if you look at the text, the he is in italics, which means that it's not actually part of the original text. It's added in to make sense in English. But as a matter of fact, what Jesus said is, I am. And Judas also, which betrayed him, stood with them. But when we continue reading here in verse 6, As soon then as he had said unto them, I am, again, the he is in italics, they went backward and fell to the ground. The name of God that spoke to Moses from the burning bush, Yahweh, the power that was able to sustain the bush without being consumed was also just as powerful when Jesus claimed the name himself in later times. The law of God is also a demonstration of Christ. The law demonstrated the need for a sacrifice to save from sin. And if you're going to demonstrate a need, God made it very clear in Genesis that the need was going to be met by the seed of the woman who would crush the head of the serpent. I'm sure as people lived, they thought, you know, I'm a pretty good person. I can live in a decent, moral way. As a matter of fact, if you look around the world, especially in the Mediterranean, you'll see people in Far East, actually, Buddhist and Hindu, thinking they could be good and make merit and make themselves a permanent place in heaven by their good works. But God communicated his law, indicating to them that, look, this is what I expect. If you're not going to match up to it, then you're a sinner, and you need my sacrifice to save you. So those are two ways that Christ is demonstrated in the book. Application. What does the book of Exodus mean for us today? Well, I believe a large amount of why Exodus even happened is communicated in Genesis 15, 13 through 16. I read a little bit of it earlier, but now I want to go back and read the whole set of verses that I wrote down there. And he, God, said unto Abraham, know of a surety that thy seed shall be a stranger in a land that is not theirs, and shall serve them, and they shall afflict them 400 years. And also that nation whom they shall serve will I judge, and afterwards shall they come out with great substance. And thou shalt go to thy fathers in peace, thou shalt be buried in a good age. But in the fourth generation they shall come hither again, for the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet full. The iniquity of the Amorites is not yet full. Back when God was walking through the two pieces of the animals that were cut in half, when he was making the covenant with Abraham, he told Abraham, the land where you're living right now, they're wicked, but their iniquity has not completed itself. In other words, it has not come to the point where it is so bad that I want to utterly destroy them. And because of that, I'm going to give them a little bit of mercy. Now, it means that over the next 400 years, your descendants are going to go down into the land of Egypt, and they're going to be enslaved by the people of Egypt, abused. Ultimately, they are going to come back again, and when they come back, I'm going to destroy the Amorites. God promised Abraham that his children would inherit the land of Canaan, but God was not ready to remove the original inhabitants because their iniquity was not yet full. God gave the Amorites mercy. They might not have realized it at the time. And he did not destroy them while Abraham was still alive, giving him possession of the land right away. Nevertheless, the Amorites spurned God's mercy, so he moved to destroy them. Who were the Amorites, and what made them so bad that God ultimately had to destroy them? Well, if you're familiar much with the Old Testament Canaan tribes, you know that they were wholly given to idolatrous practices of the worst kind. A lot of what we know is strictly from what God communicated to the Israelites as they were getting ready to go back into the land. He told them, don't do this like the people that you're going to replace, because it's an abomination to me. One of those examples is found in Leviticus 18:21. If you can go ahead and turn there as well, that'd be great. Leviticus 18:21. All right. In verse 21, it begins, or maybe picks up in the middle, a passage where God is describing what the people in the land of Canaan were like and what he did not want the Israelites to be like. And thou shalt not let any of thy seed pass through the fire to Moloch, neither shalt thou profane the name of thy God. I am the Lord. Again, the Lord is in all caps, indicating that it is the name Yahweh. Thou shalt not lie with mankind as with womankind. It is abomination. So homosexuality was included. Neither shalt thou lie with any beast to defile thyself therewith. Neither shall any woman stand before a beast to lie down thereto. It is confusion. Defile not ye yourselves in any of these things. For in all these the nations are defiled, which I cast out before you. And the land is defiled, therefore I do visit the iniquity thereof upon it, and the land itself vomiteth out her inhabitants. Ye shall therefore keep my statutes and my judgments, and shall not commit any of these abominations, neither any of your own nation, nor any stranger that sojourneth among you. For all these abominations have the men of the land done, which were before you, and the land is defiled, that the land spew not you out also, when ye defile it, as it is spewed out the nations that were before you. So in this passage, God very clearly communicates his perspective on these sins. Included are offering their children as sacrifices to Moloch, and blatantly immoral practices, including homosexuality and bestiality and things like that. Wicked sins. But yet these were the sins that characterized the people in the land of Canaan. These are the sins that God told them he would remove them for. So God has given the United States a generous measure of blessing in the past. As we look back over our history, the U.S. has been one of the strongest powers in the world because it was built on at least a biblical foundation of order. No matter what it may be said about our founding fathers today, they weren't perfect men. A large majority left behind a heritage that demonstrated a basic respect for divinity, for God's word. And since then, we have been blessed beyond measure. But now, God's merciful blessings seem to be viewed as permissiveness. Permissive license to behave in whatever manner we want. We may not offer our children to Moloch now in our age, but America is not innocent of murder of innocent children. It is still being practiced in the forms of abortion. And God's perspective on this destructive sin that was so heinous in biblical times has not changed with the passing of time. God still hates it. He hated child sacrifice then, and he cannot stand abortion now. Furthermore, his perspective on immorality remains unchanged as well. No matter what softening labels we put on it to make it look nicer or to avoid offending people, it is still the wicked sin that God removed the Amorites and the Canaanites for back in the time of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and the patriarchs. But yet, if we look around our society today, is there much to distinguish us from a pagan society when it comes to immorality? I rather think not. It seems to become a thing that we have placed in the form of entertainment. But God still hates it. And we can be absolutely sure that God will judge not just our nation, but us as well if we do not purge it out of our own lives. God has given, is continuing to give the United States and us mercy, and he will give us mercy as we remove these sins from our lives. But just like he judged the Amorites and then eventually judged the children of Israel for falling into these sins later on, he will continue to judge the world for the sins as well. So the book of Exodus, let us go that we may serve, worship the Lord. And I know it's a bit early tonight, but that's about as far as I think I can handle it with my voice tonight, so I do apologize. Thank you for coming tonight, and let's go ahead and divide up for prayer.